hello everyone, and welcome back to the latest episode of In With The Old. We're a video podcast focused on dispelling myths, building appreciation for God's Word, and helping you rediscover the Old Testament for the life of faith. Today's episode, we are going to finish out the book of Ruth. We're covering the last few verses, and we're saving the best for last. In this last section, we get kind of the theme, the point, the telos, if I can use a theological term, of the book. It's a wonderful passage, and I'm excited to dive into it. Listeners, I hope this series has really been fun for you. It's really been fun for me. I know it's been fun for Dr. Tim. I know both of us have come away and talked after these episodes and gone, boy, there is still so much we're learning, we're growing to appreciate from the text. And we hope that has been as beneficial for you. As I mentioned, I'm joined every week by the illustrious Dr. Tim Howe. Dr. Tim, are you excited to finish Ruth?
Hey, I am excited to finish Ruth, but you started with a Greek word instead of a Hebrew word. So, you know, I won't hold it against you, but this has been so fun and enjoyable. And I'm hoping, and Brian, even as we just pray, we pray it really builds up our listeners and that it points them to Christ. So yeah, let's do this.
Well, fantastic. So listeners, every week, of course, we're reading from the text. We're reading today from Ruth chapter 4, verses 11 through 22, which is the last bit of the book. We're reading from the Christian Standard Bible. And so here we go. All the people who were at the city gate, including the elders, said, "We are witnesses. May the Lord make the woman who is entering your house like Rachel and Leah, who together built the house of Israel. May you be powerful in Ephrathah, and may your name be well known in Bethlehem. May your house become like the house of Perez, the son of Tamar, bore to Judah, because of the offspring the Lord will give you by this young woman." Boaz then took Ruth, and she became his wife. He slept with her, and the Lord granted conception to her, and she gave birth to a son. The women said to Naomi, "Blessed be the Lord, who has not left you without a family redeemer today. May his name become well known in Israel. He will renew your life and sustain you in your old age. Indeed, your daughter-in-law who loves you is better to you than seven sons, and she has given birth to him." Naomi took the child and placed him on her lap and became a mother to him. The neighbor women said, "A son has been born to Naomi," and they named him Obed. He was the father of Jesse, the father of David. Now these are the family records of Perez. Perez fathered Hezron. Hezron fathered Ram. Ram fathered Amminadab. Amminadab fathered Nahshon. Nahshon fathered Salmon. Salmon fathered Boaz. Boaz fathered Obed. Obed fathered Jesse. And Jesse fathered David. All right. So, Tim, I'm going to say that the genealogies of the Old Testament, for many people, are like the poems in The Lord of the Rings. You go, that's a cool feature. We skip over them. But we see here, no, you can't skip over genealogies. They're important. They cap off the book of Ruth just very nicely and give us kind of the purpose of this book. But that's putting the cart before the horse maybe a little bit. Let's start back at the beginning. So to set the scene, Tim, right? Last time we were talking about this passage was the climactic moment. Boaz has gone to the other kinsman redeemer and said, "You know what? You're the closest. Here's the land. You could take it. Oh, but you also have to take the Moabite woman, Ruth." And he said, "No, thank you." And Boaz jumped on the opportunity. And we basically pick it up from that point of Boaz going to the elders and saying, "I'm going to redeem this woman." So starting in verse 11, Tim, let's start walking into this passage. What do you see? Where do you go in terms of significance?
Yeah, so we hear the wedding bells ring, right? Now that Boaz has gone through every legitimate process in order to marry Ruth and redeem her, we see here the legitimation that the elders of the city bring to this. So in verse 11, he says, "You are witnesses today." In verse 10, all the people who were at the city gate, including the elders, that's an important note, said, "We are witnesses. May the Lord make the woman who's entering your house like Rachel and Leah." So the legitimation or the validity that the elders offer here is incredibly important, because it's one thing for Boaz to bring in Ruth the Moabite into his home, but it's another thing for the elders of the city and therefore the community as a whole to graft her in and treat her as an equal. And so they do. They say, we are witnesses, meaning we are in moral agreement with this. We believe this is right. We believe this is God honoring. We affirm not only the decision, but we affirm the way the decision was done. And not only that, we are going to provide our blessing over this marriage. And the content of the blessing is right there. May the Lord, may Yahweh make the woman you are marrying, may the woman who's entering your house, in other words, we recognize she's entering your house, may she be like Rachel and Leah, who together built the house of Israel. So Boaz, you picked a winner. She's one of us now. May God bless her. And we see here the coming to fruition of all the prayers that we've seen at this point in the book of Ruth. This is something we've mentioned before, but it's so beautiful, isn't it? That at the very beginning, Naomi says to Ruth and Orpah, may you find rest in the house of a husband. And here we see that blessing of the elders note the fruition of that prayer. We see Boaz saying, may you receive a full reward, Ruth, for coming and placing yourself under the wings of Yahweh. And now she finds that full reward. And it's almost like this. If this is a wedding, the elders are kind of the choir in the background who are softly singing as Ruth and Boaz are coming down the aisle. So we love this. It's in a social situation like we see Ruth in. This is the ultimate reversal. Now the elders of the people approve and affirm her right to be there, her legitimacy, and we see the blessing that they give. So Brian, maybe you can walk us through a little bit of the content of this blessing. What do we see in terms of building the house? May you be powerful in Ephrathah. May your house become like the house of Perez. Walking through the blessing in verse 11 and 12, what are some salient features that you note for us?
Well, first, I noticed that they start with the greatest matriarchs in their nation's history to compare Ruth to, and that's high praise indeed, right? Mm. When we think of powerful women of the Old Testament, of faithful, godly women of the Old Testament, as modern Christians, we might place Sarah first, right, in our minds of like, oh, right, Sarah and Abram and that story, that's significant. And no doubt at all, they would venerate her as significant, but it is both Rachel and Leah who birthed the 12 sons, right, the tribes of Israel. And so to compare Ruth to those two is just this wonderful blessing. It's a high view of her and a beautiful view of inclusion. This is something we've harped on time and time again, right? There is no more quintessential woman in Israelite history, or women rather, than Rachel and Leah. They are quite literally the matriarchs of the country. That's who Ruth the Moabitess, who is no longer going to be called the Moabitess, is being compared to, right? Mm. So that's a beautiful welcoming in into the community as well. We go further, a blessing to Boaz, right? May his name be well known. The idea of seeking a great name is something that's very significant to him, as you know, in the book of Genesis. It seems to be what drives the Tower of Babel negatively, people trying to create that. But it's what God then promises to Abram. I will make your name great. We see a taste of that, as it were, continuing to be put forward as a blessing. Boaz's name will be made well known or great in Bethlehem. And then in verse 12, we have what might seem like just an apt comparison, but we're going to see when we get to the genealogy is much more than that. We see this reference, may your house become like the house of Perez. And listeners, if you're reading just the book of Ruth, you might go, well, who's Pez Dispenser here? And I don't know, like, why are we referencing the story? Well, Perez is a son of a Levirate marriage, right? Of a woman left husbandless who had to find a kinsman redeemer to marry her. In this case, it's Tamar and Judah. Now, their coming together, shall we say, is not as beautiful as the book of Ruth. But there's some great parallels in that you have a woman taking ownership and taking, shall we say, proactive steps to ensure that the promises of God happen. And so it seems like, oh, this is an apt comparison. Boaz, you are doing the same thing, and may your house be blessed because God did bless the house of Perez. From the genealogy, though, we know there's more to this. Perez is Boaz's ancestor. Boaz himself is the product of a Levirate marriage. He now is going to become the same type of blessing that happened in his past, which is this kind of beautiful symmetry, shall we say, in the life and the lineage of Boaz, which I really like. So those are some of the things that from the blessing instantly jump to me. Now, Tim, we in verse 13 then kind of move the story forward to what happens. They get married, the wedding bells ring, Boaz approaches or takes Ruth, they become husband and wife, and he sleeps with her, and the Lord grants her conception. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, the text has never said that Ruth is barren to this point, correct? I'm not just like forgetting something in Ruth chapter one.
Yes.
But she had been married for 10 years. And listeners, you could go, that doesn't really raise eyebrows in our culture, but this is a culture without contraception. After 10 years, whether or not she would be medically infertile, she would have been viewed potentially as someone who is infertile. And, and so here we see that specifically the Lord grants conception to her. And Tim, I'm curious what your thoughts are when you see that phrase. Me, I instantly go, that's a sign of favor. That puts her in the same camp as Hannah, as Sarah, as we mentioned earlier, right? As all these women who it is specifically says after a time of barrenness, God comes and places his favor upon them. I see that significant. What about you?
I do. I do. And I think we're also meant to see the cause and effect of the elders blessing Ruth and them praying on her behalf. May the Lord multiply your offspring. May you, may he build a house for you. And then immediately following, we see the answer to that blessing. The Lord opened her to be able to conceive. And so as we think about the cause and effect, we tend to think of it as a biological reality, but they would have seen it exactly the opposite. And they would have seen in a, in essence, the Lord's legitimacy and the Lord's validation of this marriage as he opened her womb. This is God's stamp of approval. Yes, this is right. In case there were any doubt, in case there were any wanderers like, well, I can't believe what these elders did. No, God opened her womb. The marriage is legitimate. God blesses the offspring from the marriage. And so God gives his approval even as he opens her womb. An incredible exclamation point on the end of this blessing. This is the full reward of her inclusion. And then, so Brian, in verse 14, it's interesting, right? Because now the scene shifts back to Naomi. We see Boaz, and of course, Boaz's name does become great. That's not what he was aiming for, but that's what God does. As, again, we're going to see that in the genealogy. But the focus in verse 14, you have Naomi, who the women go to Naomi and they say, blessed be the Lord who has not left you without a family redeemer today. May his name become well known in Israel. The tables have fully turned, right? So what do we see here in your opinion, Brian, as we look to the change in the social circumstances of Naomi in verse 14 and following?
Well, I think we see the inversion of her social situation right at the end of chapter one, where she was saying, I'm feeling abandoned. The Lord has set his affliction against me. Call me Mara. This is a beautiful inclusio to bring it back that probably, and it says the women say to Naomi, right? Back in chapter one, it's to these same women, most likely, that she voiced her complaint or voiced her understanding of where she's at. She's saying, I'm feeling abandoned. I'm feeling lost. They now come to him or come to her rather and say, blessed be the Lord who has not left you. Yeah. He's not left you without a family redeemer today. May his name become well known in Israel, right? It's this beautiful reminder that God is not just with Ruth and Boaz. Naomi's here too. And she has been included in, it is her son, right? Because of Levirate marriage, we're going to consider in some ways Obed, the product of her and her husband's lineage. It's a beautiful bringing her back in as well. And they have, even as they're talking to Naomi, some high praise for Ruth. So Tim, tell me if I'm overreading this, but they say your daughter-in-law, right? She's fantastic. Everyone loves her. But they specifically have this phrase in verse 15, which I, when I read it, I circled it and I pondered it and I'm like, no, there's something significant here. Your daughter-in-law is better to you than seven sons. Now, I don't want to like overread as a modern person here, but in an ancient agrarian society, sons are generally preferred to daughters. That's in part due to the patriarchy. Sorry, that was the time. But also just from a utility standpoint, they can go and do more things that are necessary for protection. It would be a common understanding like, yeah, I want a son rather than a daughter. So I think it is so just beautiful when they come to her and say, your daughter is not just better, your daughter-in-law rather, is not just better than sons. She's better than seven sons, right? Yeah. She's being put forward as this just wonderful, godly woman, that this is what you'd want a person of God to be like. Mm-hmm. Am I pushing too much in there, or what do you think?
No, this is the highest praise that anyone could have given to Ruth. She is a woman who loves the Lord. She is a woman of valor. She is a woman who's now an Israelite, but she has become to you better than seven sons, because now through her, your line is continued, your social status is renewed, and actually, the miracle of all miracles, had Naomi not lost her sons and had the situation not progressed as it did, Naomi would have been a name lost to history. But now Naomi becomes not just the grandmother of Obed, but she becomes grafted into a kingly line, so that God sees her misfortune as she would have seen it. And God fully does reward not only Naomi, but he fully rewards Naomi because of Ruth. And this is why Ruth is better to her than seven sons, because Ruth did not abandon her kindness to the living and the dead. Ruth would not listen to Naomi when Naomi said, go back to the house of your mother. Ruth stuck it out, which is why she is a woman who is, in the mind of these other women, beyond comparison. And just as a small social note, that is no small thing for both Naomi and Ruth. The women there accept them. The women see them as worthy of the highest possible praise. And so, yeah, it's an amazing statement. Also, indeed, it says he will renew your life and sustain you in your old age. Verse 15, it uses that word that we saw in the beginning, right? That shuv. And this is a kind of a rare form of it. It's a hifil form. But when it says he will renew your life and sustain you, it uses that idea of return. And so in Hebrew, that again, that tying together of the narrative beginning to end really comes to fruition here. So, Brian, there's this interesting phrase, and as you read it, I noticed that you changed up the CSB translation a little bit, right? Whenever it says in verse 16, Naomi took the child, placed him on her lap, and became his nanny, you changed it to a more literal reading of the Hebrew and became a mother to him. So what do you make of this? What do you make of that idea of nanny in the CSB, but also what does it mean that she became a mother to him?
Well, we're going to have a live question. Your CSB says nanny?
It does, yeah.
My CSB, let me check. No, I'm reading the CSB. It says a mother to him.
Seriously?
Interesting. Well, which we can talk afterwards. Sometimes modern translations get updates. I'm curious there's a change. But yes, so the CSB is going for more of a sense, and the Hebrew itself, right, is literally became a mother to him. Uh-huh. And I would prefer to preserve that reading, Tim.
Yeah.
To be honest, because when we're thinking of Levirate marriage, right, and it's the continuation of lines, this is Naomi's child. This is Elimelech's child in some sense that is going to continue on their lineage, right? Now, it's through Ruth and it's through Mahlon, but I don't think it's incorrect, because we've even mentioned, I think, last time, right? Naomi gives Ruth the blessing to basically go out and take the kinsman redeemer right from her, because it is her right first. So I kind of want to preserve that. It's a little awkward. It makes it maybe a little less clear. And nanny is certainly the correct sense. She's going to be acting as a grandmother, right? Helping raise the child, not a literal mother or surrogate mother. But I want to preserve some of that textual awkwardness here to help us kind of realize there's more socially going on than we might expect. Yeah. What do you think of that?
I agree with you in every part. I love the sort of tension that a literal translation brings to it. You know, for us, it might feel like, well, what do you mean that Naomi is a mother to him? I thought Ruth is his mother. But of course, this speaks to the continuation of the family line. It speaks to Naomi's role in the life of Obed. And it speaks to, again, the Lord giving her a fullness. You know, Boaz could give her grain, but God could give her a child. And so we see that as the baby is born, it doesn't only say in verse 16 that she became a mother to him. In verse 17, it says the neighbor women said, a son has been born to Naomi. And they named him Obed, and he was the father of Jesse, the father of David. So again, the idea is the continuation of the family line, that Naomi is no longer empty. She now has someone who, even as she takes care of this baby in his infancy, the baby will grow up to be someone who can take care of her in her old age as well, mm-hmm. at which point she is fully supplied at the hands of God. And she is no longer Mara, but she is Naomi, and Naomi who is blessed. So
Tim, what's the copyright on your CSB? So I'm reading from one that's copyright either 2017 or 2018.
Okay.
Or either thin line or reference. So while you look at that, oh, go ahead.
Yeah, mine's copyright 2017. So
interesting.
Yeah. Yeah.
You maybe have you need to like frame that, because I've now checked two different sources. The CSB reads mother there. Fascinating.
Yeah. Very good.
Anyway, when we look at the child's name, it is an interesting name, right? Obed. Mm-hmm. I don't believe there's another Old Testament character named Obed, right? Mm-hmm. Names sometimes mean things, and in this book, names have certainly meant anything. Does Obed mean anything, Tim?
Yeah. So Obed is very likely derivative of the word for servant. But there's
Avad.
Yeah. So there's also, though, this unique, this one-time instance in the Old Testament where, rather than a father and mother naming the child, it says here, the neighbor women said, a son has been born to Naomi, and they named him Obed, right? Mm-hmm. And again, this is indicative of a full inclusion, not only for the mother, but for the child. And we cannot overstate the importance of this. It's not just that Ruth was grafted in, but that Ruth's line from then on out is grafted in. It's not just that Ruth, we're going to include her because after all, she's the exception. She's not really a Moabite, but man, her mm-hmm. kids, that's Obed the Moabite right there. No, the neighbor women named Obed, the people who most intimately knew Naomi and Ruth, they saw this child, they named him. And this is, you know, kind of that picture of all of the old ladies in the nursery when a new baby is born in the church and they say, I want to hold him. No, I want to hold him. No, I want to hold him. This is the legitimation, not only of Ruth, but of all of her offspring. And we see that as they name him, they are in a sense exercising a right here that's usually reserved for parents. And yet they say, no, we want everyone to know, if you mess with Obed, you're messing with us. So I love it. It's again, a picture of this fundamental idea. And by the way, these are the same social dynamics in a sense that are at play with the birth of Jesus, where in mm-hmm. so many ways, we see even in John chapter 8, right? What do the Pharisees say of Jesus? Are we not right to say you are a son of a Samaritan? They look at him and they say, because of your birth, you are illegitimate. Well, according to the neighbor women of Bethlehem, the birth of Obed is legitimate, and they are giving their full approval to it. So beautiful. The naming of Obed's servant. I don't know. I don't even have a guess as to why that would have been his name. But perhaps it's because, in a sense, his mother is a servant, right? Is this somehow a tacit nod to the servanthood of his mother, that she served Naomi? I don't know. That may be overreading it, but it's a very interesting name.
Yeah, to be sure. And we then get right after his name, if you didn't know, right, this is like the mic drop. This is the cliffhanger ending. This is the twist ending you don't see come. Obed was the father of Jesse, the father of David. Mm-hmm. And now we get to see the curtains pull back fully, right, Tim? And we get to see one of the main reasons for this book.
Yeah.
This is not just the story of a godly woman, but it is a story of a godly woman. This is not just a story of faithfulness and God being close to the outcast, being an ally of those that are disadvantaged and prejudiced against in society. It is all those things, but it's also the unveiling of God's plan in history, mm-hmm. and that this story does not occur on the periphery of that story, but in the center of that story. Mm-hmm. This is the lineage of King David. This is the lineage of the man who will bring about, if you will, the golden age of ancient Israel. Mm-hmm. And we'll dive into this a little bit next week with the wrap up of the series, but I think that's a significant point. I think one of the teaching points of the book of Ruth is this is for people trying to figure out, how do I please God? How do I be in right relationship with him? And here you have someone that, from a social standpoint in Ruth, right, would check all the boxes for don't do this. Mm-hmm. She's a Moabitess. She's this outcast. And yet she has a heart focused on God. She has a heart of love and service for others. She's in the line of the best of us from an ancient Jewish standpoint, right? And that's significant. That I think really caps off our story on a very high point. This story is not on the outside, it's on the inside of the plan of God. God does not work around and away from human issues, shall we say, but he works through them. He brings them into the middle. He uses human brokenness to show his great mercy and his great power. And this is one of the reasons why I just love, love, love this book as we come to a close. Tim, what else do we see in the genealogy? What other points do you want to bring out as we kind of finish up the text of Ruth?
Yeah, I think we see, again, just the underscoring of, even in Bethlehem, you know, considering that social situation, Bethlehem is what? Of the line of Judah. So as we see the genealogy going from Perez, right? Perez, who is the son of Judah through Tamar. And so this is, in a sense, not just even about the line of David through Obed, but it's about the entire line of Judah. As you mentioned earlier, Perez is the product of levirate marriage. This is something that was not uncommon or unique, we should say, to Ruth. This is something that, had the people of Bethlehem responded differently, they would have been, you know, cutting off their nose to spite their face. But rather, we see this is just the way that God works. He works in the midst of the brokenness of the world. He works in the midst of all of the status issues and the issues of poverty and brokenness and ethnicity. And he is able to take the most tragic situations of a lost husband, lost sons, famine, and yet weave it all together to bring us to this glorious end. So it's incredible. And at least for me, it's also a challenge of faith that as we think about our lives, depending on where you're at and who you're at in the story, you may not see how this thread is going to be weaved into God's tapestry, but it is. And we're able to see that only after it happens. We're able to see God's hand only after he reveals it to us. But what an incredible ending. And it's a sign of hope for all of us that the same God who restored Naomi, the same God who honored and blessed Ruth, the same God who gave Boaz the strength and the courage to put his neck on the line for something that could have cost him socially, is the same God that calls us to serve him as we take up our cross and follow Jesus. So an incredible story, and what a blessing to be able to read it.
Yeah, very well said, Tim. My heart, when I hit this last section and kind of finish out the book, I'm reminded and encouraged that it doesn't matter what labels society wants to place upon us. There's not a single label that exists that puts us outside the plan and will of God. There's not a single label out there that will make us unusable for his purposes or unable to follow after him. Because if there was, Ruth would probably be it. And yet she is this person, right, upheld in faith, loving God, and brought into, let's extend this, not just the lineage of David, the lineage of Christ himself, right?
Yeah.
What a beautiful encouragement, I think, for all of us when we feel downcast, when we feel, man, I feel all these things people say about me. Yeah. None of those change how God can use us and see us. So it's a wonderful passage. Tim, thank you so much for walking through this last section with us. Real quick, listeners, as a plan ahead, next week we have one last sojourn into Ruth together. We're going to kind of put Ruth in its canonical context. We'll offer some thoughts on the book as a whole. We will return to Ruth one more time later this summer. We are in the midst of trying to get an interview right now with a Ruth scholar. And so more details as we get closer to that, but that should be a really fun interview. After next week, when we finish out the book proper, we're going to jump straight into our next book. It's the Minor Prophet Habakkuk. One of my favorite books. It's going to be a great time walking into what the book says, how it can teach us about God, how it can answer some of our deep, heartfelt questions about justice, about where is God in the midst of suffering. So I'm excited to go into that. But come back next week as we finish out the book of Ruth. And friends, until next time, as always, stay cool and stay open.